mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, we're not just blowing hot air. One of the biggest events to happen in and over Findlay happens this weekend as the Flag City Balloon Fest returns to Emory Adams Park. We'll get a preview. Also this morning, it happens every few years, the Hancock County Be Healthy Now Coalition is encouraging residents to participate in the latest community health assessment survey. What is it? Why is it important? And what will it be used for? And newly confirmed nominee Kamala Harris has confirmed her new running mate. What does Minnesota Governor Tim Walz bring to the presidential race for Democrats? This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, August 7th, 2024. USA, USA, USA. We are now alone atop the standings at the Paris Olympics. Both the overall medal count and now we lead the gold medal count as well. Team USA has 24 gold medals and 86 total medals after winning seven more yesterday, which included three. There were three gold and seven more medals overall to the Americans. China remains second with 59 total medals and 22 gold. And France is third in the medal count. The host nation has 48 overall medals. So USA, USA, USA. We got a little bit of a slow start in terms of the gold medal count, but we have now come from behind to take the lead in the overall medal count. And by the way, speaking of the Olympics, maybe it's a case of when one door closes, another opens. The French pole vaulter, we were talking about him the other day, Anthony Ammirati, I think is how you pronounce his name, and the fact that he lost the pole vaulting event because of the bulge in his pants. So it may have cost him a medal, but his prominent assets may have won him a potential $250,000 contract with an adult website. So you know the story by now, I'm sure. Mr. Ammirati failed to qualify for the finals in the pole vault event when he struck the pole with his, that knocked him out of the finals. The slow motion replay went viral on the internet as the commentators for the event were struggling for broadcast appropriate words to describe what happened. But I think in this case, a picture is worth 1,000 words. Anyway, so the folks behind an adult website called Cam Soda were apparently watching the moment as well, and they have ponied up $250,000 to put his disqualifying asset to better use, as it says here in this story. According to TMZ, the vice president of this adult website reportedly wrote a letter to the athlete saying, we would like to offer you up to $250,000 in exchange for a 60-minute webcam show to show off your, minus the crossbar. The fact is that many Olympians, unless they are already famous, like the USA basketball players and, Simone Biles obviously is doing okay financially, but a lot of the Olympians have to hold down regular jobs when they're not at the Olympics. And they will, if they don't parlay their newfound fame at the Olympics into like a job as a commentator or something like that, most of them will return to the real world after they compete. So you got to think $250,000 might come in handy. We'll see if he takes them up on the offer. But as of right now, no word on whether he will go on to cash in his 15 minutes of fame there. By the way, speaking of people who had a 15 minutes of fame, the convicted Capitol rioter who became known as the QAnon Shaman will get his spear and other items back from the Justice Department on orders from a federal judge. Saw this story in the Newswire. Jacob Chansley was among those that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, 2021, and was sentenced to 41 months in prison. But he recently requested that the government return the property it confiscated from him during his arrest, which includes his horned coyote tail headdress. That completely went viral in the aftermath of the mess of January 6th. And the federal judge has said, yeah, you have to give him back his spear and his horned coyote tail headdress. So, be getting that back. And I don't know that he'll be getting it in prison, probably when he gets out of prison, but he'll get it back. Let's see. Elsewhere, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, here's a woman looking for her 15 minutes of fame. Virginia woman, Jeanette Pagliuco, I think is how you pronounce her name. She is attempting to set a new world record for attending the most live concert performances in a 7-day period. The most live concert performances in a 7-day period. Now, I don't know what inspired her to do this. I don't know if it has to do with all of the big concert tours that have been in the news. Taylor Swift and Beyonce or, you know, whoever. Anyway, Jeanette is documenting her Guinness World Record attempt on social media. So far, as of the last update, she has attended 18 shows. She has to see more than 21 in a week's time in order to break the record. So far, the performances she has attended include a performance by a Marine Corps drum corps, a mariachi band, and a concert by Steve Winwood. So, pretty exciting stuff right there. I'm not sure if that would be a record that anyone would want to break. You know what I mean? If that's that's, you're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel. There's no disrespect to the Marine Drum Corps or Steve Winwood or mariachi bands, but I can't imagine seeing 21 of those performances in 1 week's time. Man, that's torture, right? That's torture right there. That's anyway. A couple of other items here among the first things that you need to know this morning. You know how AI, artificial intelligence, has been all the rage, has been in making all of these headlines, the future of technology and all of that, tech companies and businesses going full steam ahead on everything AI. But does anybody really want AI? This was kind of interesting. Study out of Washington State University finds that consumers might already be distrustful or just tired of hearing about AI technology. So here's the experiment. When product descriptions, they put product descriptions of tech gadgets in front of consumers, and when the product descriptions included the phrase AI, they were less popular among consumers than identical descriptions which excluded the phrase AI. Consumers felt more distrustful of medical devices and automated vehicles described as using artificial intelligence, while they tended to trust low-risk products like vacuum robots more. I think it's probably just because they've been around longer, but it is a point. When AI is mentioned, it tends to lower emotional trust, according to the lead author of the study for Washington State University, Mezit Cicek. AI tends to lower emotional trust, which in turn decreases purchase intentions. So all of these companies that are rushing to embrace artificial intelligence and promote, you know, the latest and greatest AI included in their products may actually be kind of shooting themselves in the foot, as it were. I don't know, but that's what the study suggests. Are you already tired of hearing about everything AI? Is this going to be a flash in the pan? I don't think so, but I think they've got to come up with a better way of describing it, or just do it and don't use that term. It's become sort of a cliche. It's kind of interesting. And finally, speaking of technology, get ready to shell out more for your streaming entertainment. Disney is hiking prices on all of its streaming platforms. Didn't they just do this? Didn't they just raise prices? Now they're doing it again. Beginning in October, Hulu and ESPN Plus will cost a couple dollars more a month. The Disney Plus Basic will cost $9.99, and the Disney Plus Premium will cost $15.99 a month, just for Disney Plus. Disney also owns Hulu, as majority owner of Hulu, and now the Hulu with ads tier will... The Hulu with ads tier will be on par with Disney Plus Basic at $9.99, and Hulu without ads will run $18.99. And ESPN Plus, which has ads, and there's no ad-free option, I don't think, on ESPN Plus, that will cost $11.99. So increases of a dollar or two a month are coming for all of the Disney streaming platforms, just the latest. These things, you remember, most of us turned to streaming to cut the cable cord. And we were frustrated with cable because of the constantly increasing prices. And now it has become what it begat. But these streaming services. So, I don't know. I think it's going to cause even more churn. And they still have to find that sweet spot of charging enough that they can make money. And I don't think there are any of the streamers that are really making money at this point. They got to find the sweet spot between making enough money and charging too much to turn customers off. So we'll see where this goes from here. But another price hike for your streaming services. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your midweek Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, partly to mostly sunny skies today with a high in the mid-70s. Mostly clear tonight with a low in the mid-60s. This year's Flag City Night Out event, which was scheduled for Tuesday at Riverside Park in Findlay, had to be postponed due to potential bad weather conditions. Officials say out of an abundance of caution, they postponed Flag City Night Out and moved it to the rain date of next Tuesday, August 13th at 6 p.m. They say they apologize for any inconvenience, but they hope to see everybody next Tuesday. For those not familiar, Flag City Night Out is a free, family-friendly event that promotes police-community partnerships and neighborhood camaraderie to make neighborhoods a safer, better place to live. Get more on our website. As Ohio prepares to go back to school, the state has introduced a new public safety awareness campaign about school bus safety for Ohio drivers.
Drivers have to stop for school buses when they're picking up or dropping off children. Data from State Highway Patrol shows an 18% increase in citations to drivers who illegally pass a stopped bus last year compared to the year before. As part of its campaign, the safety office is making educational material available to schools, law enforcement, and other entities across the state.
WTOL 11's Kaylee Kirby reporting. Blanchard Valley Health System has named its new chief medical officer. BVHS says after a national search, Dr. Bihu Sandir will become the organization's chief medical officer in October. BVHS says it's excited to welcome Dr. Sandir back to Ohio, where she'll play an integral role in supporting their clinical goals. Get more on Dr. Sandir and see her picture in the story on our website. Cedar Point will be permanently closing a ride at the end of the summer.
After 31 seasons in operation, the Snake River Falls boat ride is set to make its final plunge next month. The ride is closing to, quote, make way for future expansion. Standing at 82 feet tall, the Snake River Falls was the tallest, steepest water plume ride in the world when it first opened back in 1993.
Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So, happening around town, it is the biggest multi-day event to happen in and above Findlay. And it is happening this weekend as Flag City Balloon Fest returns to Emory Adams Park. Kelly Bibler is with us this morning to give us a preview. Not just blowing hot air here.
We are. We are not.
It is a huge event.
Yep. Good morning.
Every year. And as always, they're coming in from all over.
Yeah. We have players that come from all over the country that come in. So it's an event that people like to come back to. We're in our 24th year. They know what they're going to get. They enjoy the community. Not just the ballooning community, but the community itself really rolls out the red carpet for them in the event.
So. Absolutely. And fortunately, we got rid of all of the nasty weather yesterday.
So
hopefully the weather will cooperate. Mother Nature will give us great weather for all of the balloons and all of that.
It looks good, but we need the stars to align for all the weather.
That's one of the things, and we often talk about it. The weather conditions have to be just right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just not having rain that is at play here.
Right. So it's more about what the conditions are up in the air than what they are on the ground. So it can look beautiful here, but if the conditions aren't right at the altitude that they're going to fly at, then obviously it's not safe for them to fly.
Right.
They have the ballooning community, they have two gentlemen that are their own weatherman. They have their own weather balloon. Mm-hmm. So, like, they've been doing it for years. They know how to do it.
And, yeah, they know what it's one of the, we often kind of joke, it's the one weekend of the year when we pay attention to wind speed in the forecast.
Yes.
I mean, it's not something that we normally, unless we get to extremes, we don't normally pay attention to wind speed. Not that big of a deal. But for the balloonists, obviously, very, very sensitive.
We all become aviators this weekend. Yes.
Exactly. So every year there are some different designs. I mean, there are some tried and true, some folks that come back every year.
Yes.
And then we get new and unique designs and things like that. What are some of the ones that we're going to be seeing floating above Findlay this weekend?
So we have five special shapes this year. One is returning, Space Cowboy. So I don't know if you saw him last year. He's pretty fun. And then we have four new special shapes this year. We have Ellie the Elephant.
Okay.
And you might have seen her. She's been on some of our promotional material. We have Lucky the Four-Leaf Clover.
All right.
That's a fun green one. You're not going to be able to miss that one.
Mm-hmm.
We have TikTok the Clock. So it looks like an alarm clock. It's got a different face on each side. And then we have the Scarecrow, which is really fun. That's another big balloon that you're going to be able to put in the air. And those special shapes, actually, they take so much more manpower and a whole different set of rules to get them inflated, to get them up in the air, because they're built different.
They're not your typical balloon shape.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So,
lot of money invested in this hobby for these folks.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, not just the balloon itself, but you know, you got to pay for the propane and you know, they like our balloon festival because we have a sponsor and we, you know, thankfully have hotels that work with us to put them up while they're here. But a lot of times they have to pay for, you know, the gas to get to where they're going. They chase the balloons. Like, it's a whole other investment.
Yeah. So truly, these are people that are passionate about what they do, because you wouldn't spend that kind of money and travel all over the country to do this if you are not passionate. And they love sharing that with folks.
They really do. Last year I rode on a balloon with a gentleman. He's a pilot named Ken Coos. He has Diamond Girl. He'll be back this year. But when we landed over by the Hunters Creek area in Findlay. And he was excited to have all of the kids come out and teach them about the balloon and have them help them get the balloon back together so we could bring it back. But yeah, he was so excited to share his love with everyone that was there.
That's part of the fun of this event is that, you know, we mentioned that it happens at Emory Adams Park, which is kind of the central location, but it really happens everywhere.
It,
you know, wherever they happen to land.
Yeah.
I would often tell the story that a couple of years ago, one of them landed in our neighborhood, and you could just, everybody came out of their house and just followed it around.
Isn't it great? Like, you see your neighbors you don't normally see, but you're out there.
Everybody just followed it around.
With a cup of coffee.
Say, where is it going to land?
In the ballooning community, there's, so they have to get permission to land on private property. So that's one of the things that the chase vehicles do is they'll go ahead, they'll send someone, knock on the door and say, hey, can we land here? If no one's home, then they're going to try to find a place where they can land.
Yeah.
But what you can do is if you have an area that's void of trees, that's more in the open, if you put a white sheet out on the ground, it tells the pilot that it gives them permission to land there.
Okay, very good. So we learned something there.
There you go. If you, I'm here to help.
And this is, there is a competition that is involved for the balloonists. I mean, yes, they do it because they love to do it, but it is more than just let's go to Findlay and fly our balloons.
Yes. So that's the other part of this event that people don't necessarily think about, but it's there's prize money available to them. And many of them, there's balloonists that just do it competitively. Like they're not, they enjoy the other piece of it, but they're there for the competition piece. So, and that's one of the things that our event does. We have a competition director and his job is to figure out what the different components are going to be, how they're going to compete this year.
And so, as I understand it, they fly to a certain target and they try and drop stuff from the balloon onto the target. And
so
you got to be skilled in navigating and you know, knowing when to little drop your
So
beanie bag or whatever.
Yeah, there's different variants of that. But yeah, usually it involves like some sort of like target on the ground that they have to hit. And whoever comes closest gets the money. So and then on Sunday... On Sunday, it's really just the balloons in the air. There's not really anything at the field. But after the flight, then we have an awards ceremony for the pilot. So we recognize and hand out the prize money. And then we recognize all the crews and the sponsors and everything. So it's kind of the wrap up for them.
So let's talk about the whole weekend. Actually begins on Friday, right?
So Friday morning, we have a media flight, which will take off probably around 7 a.m. So there'll be some balloons in the air, not all of them, but there'll be some balloons in the air. And then the everything gets started at the field around 4 o'clock. All the vendors will be open. The kids zone will be open. And the pilots are usually out there for autographs. So they have little trading cards and they like to talk with people about their hobby and, and teach people about ballooning. And many of them are second, third generation in their family pilots or they travel with their family. So that's kind of fun for them. And then everything will be open. So the balloons will be flying in the evening. We'll have the glow encounter at the field, which is always really fun when it's dark. The balloons do some fun things with glowing.
Yeah.
They're stationary. They're on the field, but they do some fun stuff. And then we have a fireworks sponsored by the Moose Lodge in Findlay on Friday night. So
Friday night fireworks, too.
Very good. And then Saturday, the balloons are only, and I like to tell people that, when the balloons aren't flying, they're not at the field. So sometimes people come out during the day and they're like, where are the balloons? And they're only flying in the morning. And then again in the evening, they're flying. And then they're in the field in the evening usually. So if you want to see the balloons, that's the time to do it. On Saturday, we have a car and motorcycle show again this year. So that's always a favorite from 10 to 2. And then we'll have music. We have Jason Wagner. He's a fun local musician. He's opening up for Friday and Saturday. And then Friday night, we have Red Wanting Blue, which is a local favorite. They're back. And then Saturday is Billy Morrison Sunset Strip. So he used to be in the band Warrant. So they play some fun, I think, 90s, 2000s music. So and really, the seeing the balloons is no cost. Watching the bands is no cost. We have great sponsors that sponsor these balloons every year and come back and help us bring this event. You can come and not spend any money. Or we have lots of food vendors. We encourage you, obviously, to eat your way through the event. But, you know, it's family friendly. You can bring the kids and, you know, in the kids area.
So, yeah, the kids area, there's plenty of music. There's plenty of food. Lots of things to do. The car show. Lots of things to do. Yeah. You mentioned the glow on Friday. Doing another glow on Saturday?
So we do it on Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
And this year, so you can come watch the glow at no cost. You can bring a chair, you can sit up, you can see them glow. But if you want to get a little more up close and personal, we offer something called the Glow Encounter Experience, where okay. we have a special area where you can sit. It's a cost. It's $55. You get 4 tickets and a parking pass. But this year, if you have the Glow Encounter tickets, you can get on the field and you can walk around while the balloons are glowing.
So, wow.
And then we have a little souvenir for you. So
very cool.
That's something special. And then you can buy extra tickets if you need to. But
and how do we get tickets and more information? You got the entire schedule on the website,
yes.
right?
So our website is flagcityballoonfest.com.
Okay.
So we have the whole schedule on there. You can buy paid balloon rides. We have tethered rides. You can see everything that's happening, and you can buy the Glow Encounter Experience passes on there.
Up, up, and away. The Flag City Balloon Fest is happening this weekend at Emory Adams Park, and we've got a link to the official website from our webpage as well, so you can get the lowdown on everything that'll be going on all weekend long. And again, we'll cross our fingers for perfect weather for all of the activities and, most importantly, the balloons. Kelly Bibler with us this morning, Flag City Balloon Fest. Thanks very much for the update.
Thanks for having us.
So this is something that happens every few years. The Hancock County Be Healthy Now Coalition is once again encouraging residents to participate in the latest community health assessment survey. Joining us this morning is Dr. Bill Coase, and this is something, like we said, that happens every few years. What exactly is the community health assessment survey?
Well, there's a couple of things related to this, let's say contextually. The hospital has a requirement from the government, the IRS, that we need, because we're a nonprofit, to look at community needs. We need to do that every 3 years. So we have done this over the past dozen years with mm-hmm. public health, and then in addition, United Way, the foundation, and the Adamus Board have been part of this. And what we do is we go out and survey as many really as we can in the community. We're especially looking for those that may have lack of resources, let's just say in general, related to healthcare, as well as the social determinants. And with that, transportation, nutrition, education. But basically, we're looking for where are the gaps in healthcare. And then the idea is, once we come up with the information, that we sit down as a community, as that group, and plan for improving the gaps, the resource needs, et cetera.
So, but you're not just going through the motions here, obviously. It's a requirement, something you have to do, but it's something, explain why it is important to do this beyond just the meeting the requirement.
Well, a part of it is, from a community standpoint, the right thing to do. I mean, we need to take care of people. I'll speak as much from, let's say, from the healthcare system. We do have a requirement, as I said, but beyond that, we also have the responsibility, if anyone comes into the emergency room, that we need to take care of them. That's an expensive way to take care of people just in general mm-hmm. when they could be seen in another venue. So part of what we do as our mission as the healthcare system, we have Kauffman Clinic, Kauffman Health Center, and take care of individuals that way. But then we also partner with a lot of different parts of the community. I mentioned food, services, transportation. The Be Healthy Now Coalition mm-hmm. brings all of those people together to look at what the problems are. And then the biggest thing, I mean, there's only a limited number of resources. So with that, we need to prioritize what we're going to do. But we do come up with plans. This cycle, the 23 through 25 cycle, we've been working as now as a healthcare system. We are responsible for three. There's 10 major things that we've been looking at in the community. From the healthcare system, we're working with diabetes. We have a big project with about 500 people that we're following with their sugars, and shown really a vast improvement overall. We're looking at what we can do with nicotine usage, especially kids and vaping. And then in addition to that, looking at mental health issues, especially with addiction. So, yes, we take the data and we use it for purposes of resource allocation.
So what types of information will you be collecting in this survey? Is it pretty much always the same stuff each time the cycle's in, or do you focus on certain areas?
Great question. It's a 20-minute survey. We decided to do it this year. Really, it was more of a change in logistics. We're doing it electronically, mm-hmm. and you can find the survey on public health area where you just link in and look. So we've collected so far around 600. The questions that are asked, some are demographic. You can be identified. We're not asking for anybody's name. Mm-hmm. But then we are asking about educational levels. We're talking about, do you have good nutrition? In addition to, are you able to get in to see a primary care doctor? Are you able to seek care when you need it? And then we're asking about chronic diseases. So we're looking, how many people have heart disease? How many people have hypertension or cancer? And then looking about the number of people that have those problems. And if they identify that they can't find resources, that helps us at the healthcare system about our recruiting, expansion of certain clinics, in addition to diagnostic testing.
So you mentioned some of the areas of emphasis that came out of the previous, the most recent survey and the most recent health plan. What are some examples of ways that this has improved or changed, or you've addressed some of the issues that have been raised from previous surveys?
Yes. So we have looked at, one would be screening for certain kinds of things. Let's say we have at the healthcare system this year put on blood pressure, as well as increasing the number of women that are getting mammograms, seeing that we're not at a benchmark level, or we're not even where a lot of other communities are. So we've looked at screening kind of things, have been one thing. The biggest thing I would say over the last 5 years, of course, we had to go through COVID, and that changed, as we've talked about before, of how people got in to be seen, screening, mm-hmm. et cetera. But the mental health issues, especially with depression and what happened with COVID, and in addition to that, the addiction problem we've had for the last 10 years, I think we've learned a lot from the data that we've gotten back, especially some of these committees that have looked at things of what we can do in the emergency room. We started a Suboxone help plan coming out of the emergency room, so we're getting to people quicker. We had started the MOMS program of anyone to take care of them if they're pregnant. Mm-hmm. So out of this data, we have found things. One of the things we are in the survey really trying to emphasize is we'd like to get, let's say, some of those people that are on the margin or are not exactly in the middle of the community, put mm-hmm. it that way, especially lack of resources, like I said, to see what their needs are.
So have there been instances where the results have surprised you or yielded identified areas that maybe you didn't recognize? Because I'm sure that there are some of the results, perhaps many of the results, when you get them in, you say, yeah, that's kind of what we expected. We already knew this. It confirms what we already knew. But are there things that you've discovered that maybe have been surprising that you didn't realize were issues?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. First, I have to go out and walk around and know we got an obesity problem. Mm-hmm. I don't need data to show that. I think in my opinion, especially with teenagers, the things that we've seen with mental concerns, mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that they have a diagnosis. The vaping issue, the numbers that were being used from what we've seen. And there's still an awful lot of people that are still smoking that I wouldn't see out in the community because of limitations of what you can do. So, we do pick up things.
So we establish what the survey is and why it's important. Talk a little bit about what happens once you get all of this data. You sit down and, you know, take us through that process of putting this report together.
So we have a someone helping us that has done this before. So we'd like to see as much as we can statistically, this is information that is useful. That's why we need as many people.
Right.
We had a meeting yesterday with the groups. There is this coalition of about 7 or 8 people that look when the data comes in and make determinations of what might may be needed. And in the buckets are behaviors. We're looking at outcomes of what, let's say, suicides, overdoses, addiction issues. And then in addition, and that would be part of mental health. So once we get all of the data, that group sits down and looks at what are opportunities for what we may already have these, but people aren't aware of them.
Yeah.
So we need to come up with education for that, or we need to get into the schools. The biggest thing that I've learned through this over the past dozen years being involved, it does take a community. You need everyone. I mentioned the school systems. They are part of this. So how do we get to those? Obviously, they're still in school. Mm-hmm. The university is part of that. In addition to the business community and the nonprofits and the healthcare organization.
So the survey is out now, and as you mentioned, it is online. Takes about 20 minutes to get through, you
Well,
mentioned?
I think I did it in about 15, but I think so for most people, 15, 20 minutes.
So not a huge amount of time. When do you need to have all of those? I mean, how long will that be out there? When do you hope to have all of the responses completed?
Well, this is a cyclic, as I said. So we really don't have to have the information completed till towards the end of the fall.
Okay.
And we're going to go as long as we're getting. We continue to get individuals. Like I said, we're up to 600. Ideally, I'd like to have at least 1,000. Then we will take next year, the first half of the year, to come up with a plan. We will distribute that to the community for feedback. We will ratify a final proposal, and then we will begin the cycle in 26.
And we will look forward to hearing more about what the surveys reveal and what the information yields. As you mentioned, very important. The more responses you get, the more accurate information and more useful information you have.
Yes, for sure. We know where. And the other thing is, again, with the whole community being involved, like the YMCA working on their project for child care, the Parkinson's group that's working on that, we see those, that the ROSC of what's been done with addiction. All of those things make a big difference, make our community better.
We've got a link on our webpage for more information about the survey and the link to take you to the survey from the Hancock Public Health website at goodmornings.net, so you can find it there. Again, Dr. Bill Coe is with us this morning. Thanks very much for
dropping. Thank you. Appreciate everyone filling out the survey.
You're listening to Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Okay, so this story in the broken news is really kind of interesting. Raised some eyebrows for me because this is a perfect example of people not really thinking things all the way through, not really thinking the punishment for the crime all the way through. Let me just tell you what happened here. It's out of New York. A New York transit system cleaner, worker, custodian, I guess, in the New York transit system, has been accused of claiming to be injured on the job in order to avoid working. He wanted to collect workers' compensation, not have to actually go to work. Let's see here. Henry Herring is his name. They suspected that that's what was going on, that he had faked an injury just to be able to claim workman's comp. And he copped to it to investigators. When he was confronted, he admitted, "My goal was to have the summer off because it was too hot down in the transit system tunnels to be working in the summertime." Prosecutors say Mr. Herring claimed he was injured on the job, but actually cut his own hands. He claimed that he was pushed and cut by a train passenger, but surveillance video from the 179th Street station did not match his story, which was his undoing. So what caught my eye about this, and what makes it a little bit weird, and again, I think maybe they didn't really think this through, Mr. Herring, who was hired as a transit cleaner last year, has been suspended from his job. Which essentially, isn't that giving him exactly what he wanted? You don't want to work? Well, we're not going to allow you to work. That pretty much gives him exactly what they should have sentenced him to, go back to work, doesn't it? I mean, wouldn't that made more sense? But no, they suspended him from his job. It was kind of weird. Let's see here. A couple of stories out of Florida today, which is always fun. Food fight stories, quite literally. A woman in Florida, where was this at? I don't know exactly where in Florida this was. Just says a Florida woman has been charged with domestic battery after she allegedly threw a soft-shell taco at her spouse during an argument about getting him food from Taco Bell for his birthday. It was his birthday! Dr. Eshra Persad, a 34-year-old dentist, struck her husband of 5 years in the face with, and there was some confusion, it was either a taco or a burrito. The arrest report lists it as both. So, anyway, striking him in the face with either a taco or a burrito, the fast food projectile was still on the victim's face when police arrived, according to the report. Dr. Persad told police that she threw a burrito at the victim after he threw a bag at her, a claim that he denied. The victim was not hurt as a result of the incident, but Dr. Persad was arrested for domestic battery and booked into the county jail, later released on her own recognizance. Wonder if she was ordered to stay away from her husband or stay away from Taco Bell, one or the other. Meanwhile, a St. Petersburg man in Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, man has been charged with domestic battery after a Sunday night spaghetti dinner got a little too spicy. Anthony Fiacco, age 41, was having dinner with his 61-year-old mother when the two got into a verbal argument that turned physical, according to a police report. Mr. Fiacco then threw the pasta at his mother, striking her in the head and leaving her with spaghetti sauce in her hair. Police were called in and allegedly found Mr. Fiacco, who had fled the scene, hiding behind a bush in the backyard of the house. He then tried to run away from officers, who managed to capture him, and now he faces several charges. By the way, this is not the first encounter with the cops for Mr. Fiacco. He has previous prior convictions for battery, trespassing, violating probation, and throwing a deadly missile. That charge involved a Heineken bottle throwing it into an apartment window after being asked to leave a party. So. This sounds like a really fun guy. Alrighty then. Real winner there. Again, how would you like to go to jail and have to explain to your cellmate what the charges are? What are you in for? I threw spaghetti into my mom and got spaghetti sauce in her hair. Don't mess with me. Back off. I have marinara and I'm not afraid to use it. A 42-year-old Canadian man is facing charges after he is allegedly found trying to enter the U.S. In Port Huron, Michigan, with 266 pounds of cocaine. Wow! 266 pounds. Sebojan Sathaselan had his bond set at $3 million. He was arrested this past Thursday afternoon, driving a truck across the Blue Water Bridge between Port Huron and Sarnia, Ontario. But 266 pounds of cocaine. Did you think he was going to sneak in 266 pounds of cocaine? That's, wow, 266 pounds. Yeah. And finally, in the broken news, this one fairly close to home. I thought this was kind of weird. Officials in Akron say that I-76 is now back to being fully open. The interstate had been closed in both directions yesterday morning from the Central Interchange to the Kenmore Boulevard exit after police and fire crews found some type of suspicious item in the roadway. A suspicious item in the roadway, Interstate 76 in Akron. Officials say the suspicious item was determined to be a barrel. A barrel. I don't know, is that like a road construction barrel? That was the first thing that popped into my mind. But I would imagine that you would have to be able to recognize those. It's not like they are incredibly rare in this state and should be easily recognizable. A barrel. Everything's okay. It's just a barrel. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
WFIN has the opening tune-up for the Findlay Trojans on Saturday as they scrimmage Toledo St. Francis. This is Tim Montgomery, and WFIN will bring you the action live from Donnell Stadium at 10 a.m. Then get set for another exciting season of Trojan football with the opener on Friday, August 23rd at Toledo Central Catholic. The Trojans play here on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. We are coming up on the end of summer vacation season with kids heading back to school soon and all of that. If you are among the millions that took a trip this summer, what did you forget to take along on vacation with you? It always happens, doesn't it? You always forget something. No matter how well you plan, you always forget something. So the folks at Talker Research wanted to find out what are the most common things that people forget when they go on vacation. And from a new survey they put out there, 2,000 adults, the most common forgotten item when people go on vacation, 1/3 of travelers forget to bring, what do you think it is? The phone charger. Their phone charger is the most commonly forgotten item. Kind of interesting. The second most common, 32%, say a beauty product or a personal care item of some sort. So that could be, you know, like shampoo, deodorant, you know, makeup, whatever it might happen to be. Some beauty product, 32%. 27% say they have forgotten sunscreen. Which is kind of interesting because usually when I go on vacation, you know, like the beach or whatever, I buy the sunscreen when I get there. I don't take it with me. But that was number three on the list. 18% have forgotten their medication. So that's it. 42% of those in the survey say their forgetfulness actually turned the start of their vacation into a bit of a sour note. 27% say that they were forced to scrounge and spend more money on stuff that they already have at home. And 25% say that when they have to do that, they have to settle for something that is not their usual brand. It's whatever you can find at the destination when you get there. So let's talk a little politics this morning. The big news yesterday, duly confirmed nominee Kamala Harris has confirmed her new running mate. So what does Minnesota Governor Tim Walz bring to the presidential race for the Democrats? Our go-to analyst for this most unusual presidential election cycle is with us once again, Professor Alan Sanders, former Time Magazine senior reporter and professor emeritus of political science, St. Peter's University in New Jersey. Professor Sanders, thanks very much once again for joining us on the program. Were you surprised at all at the selection of Tim Walz as the running mate for Kamala Harris?
Good morning, Chris. No, not really. I mean, he was one of the three top choices that she was considering, and it was clear when he came out and when they gave their speeches yesterday in Philadelphia that they agree with each other and that they have a certain chemistry that works between them. It's been said, it's been reported, that Kamala Harris wanted somebody whose chemistry would align with hers, and it seemed to be the case yesterday. It was quite a raucous rally, and I think for the Democrats, they view it as a very good and strong launching point for the ticket.
It's kind of interesting because he was probably of the reported finalists for the position. He was maybe the least known, but at the end of the day, I can't really say that I was surprised either, because I would have been surprised had the Democrats, looking at the broader political landscape here. If you select Mark Kelly from Arizona, you put a Senate seat back in play in a swing state. If you pluck Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania, you give up a governor's seat in a swing state. So do you think that actually played any part in, making that decision, those broader considerations?
Yeah, and I think one of the big considerations was the upper Midwest, the upper Midwest heartland, the blue states, as we've all come to know them, and certainly in Ohio you understand that very well. I think what probably made Kamala Harris think that Mr. Walz would be a good number two is that he has come across in the past, and certainly he came across at the rally, as a plain-spoken kind of everyman from rural America. And she believed that that sort of balances the appearance of the ticket. She's from California, from a liberal area of the country. And so although Walz's governor's record is a liberal record, nonetheless, his background and his demeanor presents a kind of plain-spoken everyman, and I think she believed that would be appealing to many voters, particularly in the upper Midwest.
You mentioned his record, and obviously Republicans have seized on that, although the statement in response to the selection, I kind of felt like was already written, and they were just waiting for the name to pluck in there. It would have been the same basic response, regardless of who had been chosen. But I did hear, and you touch on something that I think was interesting. I did hear one analyst say that maybe what the Democrats are trying to do is reach out to those Midwesterners and shed that image that Democrats have gotten of late as being the party of coastal elites, sort of trying to recapture the middle of the country, both geographically and politically.
Well, that's right. And, we speak a lot about populism. I mean, the Republicans say they're kind of the MAGA movement is a populist movement. And populism, generally speaking, opposes elite institutions. I think Governor Walz's record is trying to show, or the Democrats will try to show, that his record as a liberal fit with the populist image. I mean, liberal thinking also opposes elite institutions when they don't serve the people's interest. That's part of the liberal ethos. Mm-hmm. And so I think the Democrats want to point out that there is such a thing as liberal populism, and that Governor Walz is just that kind of a candidate, and a candidate that will work for the people from a liberal standpoint. They also like the fact that when you actually get down to certain issues, certain important issues, America agrees with a liberal view of those issues, such as abortion or universal background checks for guns, free school lunches, broad access to health care. Those are issues that resonate as popular issues for the Democrats. So they will try to point that, that's populism. Populism from the liberal standpoint, and a standpoint that should garner a majority of votes. Now, of course, we'll see if that's true, but that's the case they will make.
It is really interesting that they maybe have come to this realization, because I remember when Donald Trump won the election in 2016 over Hillary Clinton, and I asked the head of the state Democratic Party to explain how it is that Midwestern blue-collar workers, which were at one time the bread and butter of the Democratic Party, ended up picking a multimillionaire real estate investment person from New York as somebody who better represented their interests than the Democratic Party. And really didn't have an answer to that, but I got to think that that's a question that's been asked for a number of years in the Democratic Party. How do we let this group of individuals slip through our fingers? And how do we redefine ourselves as that?
Well, that's right. And certainly Democrats have been scratching their heads trying to figure that out. I think one of the reasons that has happened, not the only reason, is that the Republicans have focused on so-called cultural issues.
That
has appealed to many working-class Americans. The Democrats want to focus on social and economic issues and point out that on that those sorts of issues, they're more in tune with working-class Americans. So it's a tug-of-war between cultural issues and, social and economic programs that Democrats espouse and say actually work for the working class. And that's been the tug of war for many years now. Mm-hmm. Democrats think they have now an energized campaign where they can make that case, but of course they're still the underdog when you take a look at the polls. So they have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, that's the big question is if they believe that they have come to that realization and finally found the magic formula, the perfect ticket for this, is it too little too late? And I guess that will be the crux of the coming 90 days or so that we have until the election. So moving forward, I mean, we talk about, what Tim Walz brings to the ticket for the Democrats. Kind of frame this partnership and how it will be portrayed on the campaign trail moving forward over these final 90 days, this final 90-day sprint to the election.
Well, I think there was a word said during the rally yesterday that sort of epitomizes the approach that the Democrats will take. The word was joy. We want to bring back joy to America. And I think what they meant by that, the Trump campaign has been so dark and dreary and focused on revenge, kind of a revenge tour. Mm-hmm. And Democrats wanted to point out that they're not interested in revenge. They're interested in the future. So you heard the word joy and future. Certainly they want to contrast themselves with Trump and his dark vision of America and his views. But they want to say, look, an election is about what a ticket can do for you. And what we want to do for you, the Democrats seemed to say last night, is we want to bring back hope. We want to bring back economic vitality. We want to bring back policies that the majority of Americans seem to want to see going forward. And so they will present a vision of the future. Here's what we can do for you, as opposed to what they say. Trump argues that here's what I want the office for me for. And so I think that will be the contrast that they will try to make. And I think they started to make that contrast last night at the rally.
We will see if it works, if the Midwestern appeal is enough in what will certainly be a very closely contested election. And obviously, we look forward to the Democratic National Convention coming up here very soon. And what, if any, kind of a bump the ticket gets from that event is usually happens in these campaigns. Again, Professor Alan Sanders is with us, former Time Magazine senior reporter, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, St. Peter's University in New Jersey. Helping us break it all down, Professor Sanders, thanks very much once again. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, Chris.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Let me give it to you again, goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll get details on the upcoming screening of an award-winning film by a pair of local artists, which examines how their fellow artists are using their talents, often covertly, to fight decades of totalitarian communist rule and oppression in Cuba. It is a fascinating story. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.